Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Let's see, texting while driving. That would be TXT while DRV equals BAD.
Yes, I'm a professional truck driver, and texting is the scariest thing I see.
BFD.
This is Neil. I was biking and using my cell phone and got a craniotomy as a result.
TMI.
Just trying to make a living and stay alive when there's people texting all over me, and it's worse than drunk, worse than grandma and grandpa in a motorhome.
LOL. No laughing matter. Technologically induced distracted driving. When your BlackBerry gives you a lobotomy... The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Wednesday, September 30th. You better not be texting out there. I'm John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, John. I'm not texting while hosting. Okay, that's not that's a health risk. But speaking of health, Takeaway pal Todd Zwillick is going to break down yesterday's big moves on the healthcare overhaul. And it's Wednesday, so we're going to be talking about and eating food.
But first, Alicia Jones. Now, you're 19 years old, right?
Yes, I am.
Really quick question for you here. How many times can you text during a red light?
Well, I don't know. I'm a pretty fast texter myself, but I normally try and save all my text messages to respond to when I'm at the red light.
When you're at the red light. So how many texts can you do during a green light?
I'm kind of worse with that one.
Yeah, right. Fewer, but you still do it, right?
Yeah.
The difficulty of resisting texting while driving. Part of our discussion when we continue in a moment. Stay with us, Alicia. Right now, everything else you need to know this morning.
In the headline, witnesses report multiple home and bridge collapses in western Indonesia. A powerful earthquake hit there earlier today. A tsunami alert, though, is no longer in effect. That's as President Obama has declared a major disaster in American Samoa. A South Pacific earthquake triggered a deadly tsunami there. At least 99 are dead, dozens more missing in Samoa and American Samoa. And in the healthcare debate on the Hill, despite two defeats in the Senate Finance Committee, supporters for a so-called public option aren't giving up. They say they'll fight for it on the full Senate floor. Senators voted down plans to add the so-called public option to the current bill.
The White House is doing a lobbying campaign. They sent a heavy hitter to Copenhagen today to sell Chicago as the site of the 2016 Summer Games. First Lady Michelle Obama is lobbying for the Windy City. It's in a tight race against Rio de Janeiro, Madrid, and Tokyo. President Obama will follow up his wife's work later on in the week. Toyota is issuing its biggest U.S. recall ever on floor mats. In nearly 4 million cars, they could jam the gas pedal. Toyota is telling owners to immediately remove driver's side mats on Camry, Prius, and some Lexus models. So Wall Street dipped slightly yesterday. The Dow opens next hour at 97.42. The S&P starts trading at 10.61, and the Nasdaq begins at 21.24. Do you talk? Do you text? How distracted are you when you drive?
Hi, I'm Claudia. My driving distraction sin is trying to attach my hands-free while I'm driving.
It's not a silly matter. It's the subject of a summit in Washington. We're going to talk about it in just a moment. Distracted driving, give us your confession at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Are we offering absolution?
No, actually not. Probably going to do a little scolding.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Morning, everyone. So, you know, I hate that term, perfect storm. People use it all the time. But in this particular case, it applies. There is a perfect storm of events that really make it difficult for us drivers. Do you text while you drive, Celeste?
I do not text. I talk on my phone. I don't text.
Yeah, right.
I don't.
Well, you lived in Los Angeles for a while, right?
I did.
People spend more and more time in traffic jams.
Going 2 or 3 miles an hour.
Exactly.
And I will admit that I brought a book with me to read while I was on the freeway.
I mean, it's an impossible temptation. You're getting nothing done.
You're
right?
Going 2 miles an hour.
you want to try to use that time productively.
That's right. You literally don't have your foot on the gas pedal because your car in just without hitting the gas is going fast enough.
So more and more time in traffic jams, all right? Okay. Couple that with a proliferation of technological devices that allow you to communicate more or less constantly. Right, Alicia?
Yep.
It's a pretty tough road to hoe. Alicia Jones, you're 19 years old. You have very difficult time resisting texting, correct?
Yes, I do.
And this is actually a serious argument in your own family, correct?
Yeah, me and my dad have different opinions on that.
So Alicia Jones from New Jersey, right? And your dad is Officer Sergeant Stephen Jones of the New Jersey State Police. Sergeant Jones, good morning.
Good morning, John and Celeste.
So how often do you meet up with drivers like your own daughter?
Far too often. And unfortunately, some of the times we meet them are in the worst of circumstances, too, during a crash.
And, you know, in many ways, the most macabre aspect of this is that the texting device often leaves a record of the actual accident itself, either in the audio on a phone call or the garbled text message that becomes the sort of last communication of somebody if the accident turns out to be fatal. Right, Sergeant?
That is morbid, yeah. Unfortunately, it does happen. The recordings often do not pick up something like that because phone calls are normally not recorded, but certainly someone else, a friend or a loved one, is going to be the witness to that.
Well, each year, millions of Americans take their eyes off the road, and it's a reason what we're talking about right here is part of the motivation for the Federal Department of Transportation convening a distracted driving summit in Washington, D.C. Elected officials will be a part of it, lawmakers, transportation experts, all talking about this subject that was raised by our producer, Jim Colgan, who confronted some drivers who were distracted and also moving at about 1 mile an hour near our offices in Lower Manhattan on their way into the Holland Tunnel.
I don't text when I'm driving.
Every now and then I'll text, but in traffic like this, but not when I'm going fast or anything like that, or in the highway.
No, I don't.
You don't? Is that an earpiece in your head?
Yes, it is.
So you do talk on the phone, though?
Well, yes.
But you don't think that's distracting?
Well, I draw the line by not making phone calls, because with this I can voice activate my phone, and no texting.
Distracting? No.
I'll let you go. Thanks.
So also joining us is Kristen Backstrom, who's a senior manager of the AAA Foundation for Traffic Safety. Good morning, Kristen.
Good morning.
You're in Washington, D.C. I suspect you'll be attending that summit that convenes today in Washington, right?
I'm actually on one of the panels to talk about the prevalence of distracted driving in our society. I have to say I'm a little bit terrified by Alicia's comment, but it does reinforce the results of a survey that I heard about recently, where teens actually believe the distraction while they're in the car is driving. They want to use that time to communicate with their friends through all available means, check the latest music, download, check their computers. But the actual physical act of driving, they find, gets in the way of them doing what they want to do when they're in the car. As a spokesperson or a participant in the traffic safety community, I find that unbelievably shocking and really scary. We know.
Yeah, you have to be a little sympathetic, Kristen. I mean, the law on this is all over the map. You can hear people in those conversations that we recorded trying to make their own rules. And you've got all sorts of technological temptations. I mean, when the summit convenes today in Washington, they're in a real predicament. I mean, the law just really has not kept up to date with technology and certainly with young people's behavior, right?
That is an interesting way to put it, but I am not going to agree. I think we have a real societal problem on our hands. We tolerate more than 40,000 lives lost every year on the road at an economic cost of more than $300 billion. We know that distraction is implicated in up to 8,000 crashes every day. Our drivers absolutely believe that it's unacceptable for drivers to send text messages or email at just about the same rate as they believe it's not okay to drink and drive.
Okay, Kristen, hold on 1 second. Alicia, it sounds like Kristen Backstrom of the AAA Foundation for Traffic Safety is calling you a social problem.
Well, I am social. sociable, but I'm not sure about a social problem.
But she's terrified by your behavior and the apparent cavalier attitude that you have about texting while you're driving. Is she right?
I don't really think so. See, my problem is I really don't feel like stopping the car like every 5 seconds to answer a text message. My dad's like, oh, well, why don't you just pull over? It's a lot easier. You can just answer it then. But I get so many texts a minute.
What kind of a device do you have, Alicia?
It's the MV2. It has that screen where you can flip it up and it has the keyboard inside,
I
or
think
you can text
if,
out.
If you look on the right side of it, I think there's a button there. It's called the off button.
It's just a convenient thing, really.
Alicia. Well, Alicia, your dad is absolutely right. You are substantially at risk of crashing your car. And this is a huge problem. People just really don't appreciate and act on what we know is a serious risk to not just your safety, but other drivers on the road. I mean, would you get behind the wheel after you'd been drinking and drive? No, but we have
not. Well, let's hear her answer. Let's hear her answer. Alicia?
Would I get behind the wheel if I were drinking and driving?
Yeah, your dad's on the phone now, remember.
Of course, I don't even underage drink.
Yeah, she's 19.
All right.
Well, that's a great step right there, but I think it's important for society to start recognizing that when you are distracted behind the wheel, you are not being safe, and you're putting other people and yourself at risk.
Sergeant,
your dad's job is to help keep the roads safe for all users.
Sergeant Jones, let me ask you, are we really talking about young people here? I mean, it's not just teens and young 20s that are doing this. What are some of the worst things you've seen, and what are the average ages of the people who are getting in these wrecks from using their cell phones?
It's not just young people, and in general, rear-end accidents are probably the most common type of accident we find, especially during the commutes. Well, you're hardly going to be finding a rear-end accident that was not caused by somebody looking away, looking down, or doing something else. And that, of course, ranges through all ages. It's all commuters. It's anybody on the road who's just adjusting a radio, speaking to a child in the back seat. It can be really any number of things that can distract us. I think the most egregious is the texting while driving, though, because it just takes so much of your attention away.
Well, Sergeant, I have to admire your daughter's candor in coming on the program with you to talk about her behavior, and I don't want to leave the impression to our listeners that we're a bunch of preachy adults just ganging up on a 19-year-old here. But of the people that you've pulled over, what is the dumbest, most infuriating excuse someone used to justify their texting while they were driving?
Wow. I've got to meet my daughter, and it's important that she knows exactly where I'm going to be. Well, none of those things are so time critical that that father in that case should have been risking his own ability to meet her. A lot of the excuses are antithetical to what the real goals are.
But you know, Stephen, and also Kristen, what as a parent, how if you even you as a New Jersey State Patrolman can't get your daughter to drive more safely or get her to practice better things, how do I, who's not a New Jersey State Patrolman, what do I do with my son when he's of driving age?
Well, you know, let me take a shot at that, please. I think we've all got to walk the walk, and in preparation for this little segment, I guess I've been thinking through things, saying, well, have I been the absolute model of perfection in some of these areas? Or have I let my priorities build up in my own life an excuse for, here's why I had to dial the phone this time because this was important.
Well, let's ask the expert. Alicia, does your dad walk the walk and talk the talk?
He is constantly on his phone.
Oh, boy.
There you go.
Listen, all right.
Great way to describe the problem that we have in society.
Let me put a focus question to you before the end because we're almost done, Kristen. Is the idea here that we do what we did with seatbelts, raise awareness, or do we need a whole new set of laws for these technological devices as you convene this summit down in Washington?
Legislation without enforcement is not going to work. We need a culture shift of dramatic proportion. 4 out of 5 drivers between the ages of 16 and 54 admit they drive while distracted on a regular basis.
All right,
it's
great
not
statistic.
Just Alicia.
We'll use that as our takeaway. Kristen Backstrom, Senior Manager for the AAA Foundation for Traffic Safety. Alicia Jones, how many times did you text during this interview?
Not at all.
Alicia Jones, 19 years old, and her father is Sergeant Stephen Jones of the New Jersey State Police. Thanks, guys.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. We've got some quick takeouts now and stories we want you to stay on top of. We'll begin with Todd Zwillick, Takeaways Washington correspondent. Good morning, Todd.
Hey, John. Good morning.
So in our last episode, the Finance Committee was dealing with certain amendments on the so-called Baucus health care bill, the Senate bill on health care reform. Yesterday, two amendments were rejected. They all concerned the public option. What happened?
Yes, public option and son of public option, really. Both went down in the Finance Committee yesterday. The first one was Senator Jay Rockefeller's public option, sort of a pure form of public option, would have a national public option sponsored by the federal government tied to Medicare prices. That would have been a lot of bargaining clout on the part of the government and members of the insurance exchange. That went down 15-8. Then a second one from Chuck Schumer of New York that was, Democrats might say, a little weaker. It used negotiated rates, so the public option would have to negotiate just like insurance companies do. That one got a couple of more votes, but still went down. Here's what Schumer had to say.
Those of us who support the public option support adding some real competition to the coagulated, ossified, and fundamentally anti-competitive insurance market. And I don't blame the insurance companies. They're doing their job. Their job is to protect their shareholders. That's what the chairman of the board and the president swear to do. But that's not our job.
Okay, so the thing about Schumer's amendment is it got two senators that Rockefeller didn't. And Schumer kind of sees that as maybe a path forward to get some more votes when the health care bill eventually reaches the Senate floor. Don't give them unlimited negotiating power. Make them negotiate on a so-called, you know, level playing field with insurance companies. Now, it's interesting, the senators who voted no on both of them, the Democrats, Max Baucus, the chairman of the committee in charge of this bill, voted no on both public options, even sort of the weaker one. And here's why. Here's what Baucus had to say.
My job is to put together a bill that will become law. In the Senate, that means my job is to put together a bill that gets 60 votes. Now, I can count. And no one has been able to show me how we can count up to 60 votes with a public option in the bill. And thus, I am constrained to vote against the amendment.
So is this democracy in action here, or the public option being held hostage in the Senate?
Well, of course, it depends on your point of view. As you heard Max Baucus say, I can count and I can't count to 60 with a public option on there. So it's up to Schumer and the other supporters to now round up enough wavering Democrats, if you want to call them that, or moderate or conservative Democrats who don't like the public option, round up enough of them to convince Max Baucus and, for that matter, Harry Reid, that they can get to 60 with it on there. And one more thing I need to tell you, John. It's interesting, some of the senators also who voted against both public options. Look at Blanche Lincoln, who's a moderate Democrat from conservative Arkansas and is up for re-election in 2010. She voted no against both versions of this. So she obviously thinks in her state at this point she doesn't want to vote for something that's going to endanger her chances. You know, people like Evan Bayh of Indiana, again, moderate from a conservative state, up for re-election. Those are the ones they have
to
convince.
That's the formula. All right. We'll keep counting. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks so much.
And now on to business with Lee Story, the finance reporter for our partners, the New York Times. The Securities and Exchange Commission is maybe cracking down on short selling. Short selling is when you sell a stock, you bet that it's going to go down so that you can buy it back at a profit. So, Louise, why does the SEC want to crack down on short selling?
Good morning. So short selling really came onto a lot of people's radar last year. You know, we might not have heard about it before. But when a lot of short sellers were attacking the investment banks, and you might remember Morgan Stanley's CEO even publicly criticized them for driving the stock prices down. So it's really been very polarizing since then. And what the SEC is doing here is responding to a lot of the people who say that short selling got out of control in the financial crisis, and that some people think it helped Lehman and Bear Stearns fail. And so,
is that true?
What they're doing is they're proposing to bring a rule back that they had taken out in 2007. And that rule is called the uptick rule. And in, with that rule, you cannot short a stock until its price goes up a little, and then you can short it again. I was talking to one money manager yesterday, and here's how he explained it to me. He said, you know, without the uptick rule, short selling is like taking a bat and hitting someone and hitting them and hitting them and hitting them, and they can't get up in between when you hit them. And he said, the uptick rule just lets them stand up again before you hit them. And that's why he thought it should come
back.
So
why are the banks defending short selling?
So there's a division in finance. There's some people who do not want the uptick rule back, and there's some that want it. The people who do not want it there say that short selling should run free because it adds liquidity to the market. And so in that camp is Goldman Sachs and hedge funds like Citadel. Some of the ones who say short selling needs to be reined in include people like Jim Cramer of the show Mad Money. He got more than 5,000 people to sign a petition that was sent to the SEC. So it comes down to whether short selling should be reined in a little. Remember, the uptick rule would not at all ban it, but it would just rein it in a little bit.
It would just modify it. Quickly, yeah. What are the chances? How much support does this have in the SEC?
Well, it's going to be interesting to see, you know, because, again, it has become a political thing. One thing that's interesting is a lot of short sellers who were criticized last year have kind of seen their reputations repaired. One of them was this guy, David Einhorn, who was in the news a lot because he was criticizing Lehman, and he was very public and said Lehman was very troubled, and he was villainized. But since Lehman failed, mm-hmm. more politicians and bankers and you know have sought out his advice.
Coming
and
in
so,
the other way, yeah.
Exactly. So, you know, the pendulum swings back and forth. And so it'll be interesting to see just where the SEC stops the pendulum.
Okay, Louise Story, thanks. She's our finance reporter for our partners, the New York Times.
Well, you know, you can make the argument that the shorts were right. You know, you could certainly make that argument. So our last takeout comes from you, our listeners. We've been getting responses on all the questions we've been raising this week. We asked you a few days ago to tell us the housing situation on your block. Give us a snapshot of what's going on right around your driveway. It's because while rising housing sales had a slump in August, it wasn't necessarily the story on your street. Here's Susan from New Jersey.
We're actually overjoyed that there's an empty meadow within our historic district instead of the development on steroids that was approved in the boom years for this site. So here's a happy result of the downturn.
She called 877-8-MY-TAKE to tell us that story. And Rick sent us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. I live in Brooklyn. There's a big excavation near me. Several decent homes were demolished and a pit dug, then nothing. It's surrounded by a painted plywood fence that is covered with ads and rotting. I assume that when these fences become billboards, that's a bad sign. We want you to weigh in on anything on the program. Yesterday, we asked you what you thought the biggest clear and present danger to the country was. Robert emailed us, the combination of news outlets owned by entertainment corporations, rabid scorch and burn politics and fundamentalism, left, right or center. Your thoughts at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Freeman Foundation.
Coming up in just a few minutes, we'll get an update from Indonesia about the earthquake there and from Samoa about the tsunami. First, here are some of the news stories we're following at 32 minutes past the hour. We've just gotten word on a big economic indicator. Last quarter, the nation's GDP fell by 0.7%. That's less than expected, actually. Asia is facing the aftermath of two powerful quakes. Right now, there are reports of building and home collapses in western Indonesia. We'll go there for the latest from our partner from the BBC in a moment.
In the South Pacific, another quake triggered a tsunami in Samoa and American Samoa. Graham Ansell, a tourist in Samoa, tells Radio New Zealand that the situation is desperate.
We need some help around here. The whole village has been wiped out, but I guess the whole southeast coast has been wiped out, just completely wiped out. You know, there's not a building standing.
We've been estimating the death toll all morning. Right now, 99 are believed dead in Samoa and America and Samoa. Many more are missing.
Moving overseas, a U.S. serviceman is dead after a suicide bomb attack struck a military convoy in Afghanistan. President Obama meets with his national security team later today to discuss the war in Afghanistan.
Turning to Iraq, the top U.S. commander there is expected to tell a House panel today that thousands of troops could be home in late October. And the First Lady is in Copenhagen today. She's meeting with members of the International Olympic Committee, trying to get Chicago picked as the home of the 2016 Games. The president will join her later this week in Copenhagen. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
So we're getting details about the earthquake in Indonesia. Preliminary reports say an earthquake with a magnitude of 7.9 struck 30 miles off the coast of Sumatra. Joining us now is the BBC's Karishma Vaswani. She's joining us from Jakarta. Good morning, Karishma.
Good morning.
Now, Jakarta is quite a ways from where the earthquake actually hit. Did you feel it there in Jakarta?
Well, there are some people who did feel it here in Jakarta, the Indonesian capital. As you say, we are quite far away from where the epicenter of the earthquake was. Now, where that is near the city of Padang in Sumatra. That's the capital of the province. Now, over there, we're getting reports that the shaking from this powerful tremor caused buildings to fall down, houses to fall down. There's no confirmation yet because, as you might understandably, communication links to the area have been cut off. Now, we've been speaking with the Indonesian Meteorological Agency, who initially decided not to issue a tsunami warning, but they did tell us that they've asked authorities in the area to evacuate people off the coastal areas in Sumatra. Now, that's because they say they've observed unusual activity. Those were the words that they used in the waters near where the earthquake struck. And that's what's prompted the calls for this evacuation.
This quake was pretty much on the same fault line that caused the massive 2004 India Ocean tsunami that killed more than 230,000 people. Are they worried about aftershocks here as well?
Well, yes, they are worried about aftershocks, and there has been at least one aftershock since the initial earthquake struck. As you rightly point out, the earthquake was along the lines, the fault lines of what happened in 2004, and many geologists have said to us in the past that they're very concerned about this particular area. In fact, Padang in Sumatra has been highlighted as one of the places that's most at risk from a potential catastrophic earthquake, but as I've said, there's no official confirmation yet on any casualties or any injuries at this stage.
Are we talking about a densely populated area? How many people are affected from these evacuations and things?
Well, the city of Padang is home to around 1 million people, and as are most cities in Jakarta, densely populated. You'll find homes right next to other homes. The concern, of course, is the fact that the way these homes have been built, and they're very flimsy most of the time. Now, in previous earthquakes in the region, that's been one of the major causes of death, that the shaking, the strength of the shaking of the earthquake causes a lot of these homes to fall down because they are so flimsily constructed, which leads to the injuries and the deaths.
Okay, Karishma Vaswani is with our partner, the BBC. She spoke to us from Jakarta, Indonesia. Thank you, Karishma. Other big news this morning is, of course, Samoa and American Samoa. Early yesterday, residents woke up to an 8.0 earthquake that created powerful tsunamis. They've killed at least 99 people there. But as John pointed out, we're expecting that death toll to rise. It's destroyed several villages and wiped out the coastline. Joining us from Samoa is Ian Cooper. He's British. He's been living there for the past 5 years. Ian, you've had a terrible experience. Your diving business was demolished by the tsunami. Is that correct?
Yes, my diving business has been devastated, along with a lot of other businesses as well.
What about your homes? What does it look like there in the place where you live?
I actually live up in the mountain, but my business was actually based at the beach. My diving vessel is actually now, at the moment, sitting on the top of the hotel next door.
On the roof?
On the roof, yes.
Now, you went down to the beach to help people who were struggling to get out of the waves there. What was that like?
After I actually realized that the wave had actually passed, I tried to get down to the beach to see if there was any wounded or anyone who needed assistance, and also try and salvage some of my business.
What does it look like there? What does the beachfront look like?
It's completely devastated. The whole of the south coast of Apulu in Samoa is basically washed away. It looks like someone's just come through and just wiped it clean. There's big hotels that have actually just All that's left is a concrete slabs.
So, Ian, we're told that the tsunami actually hit the coast there within a matter of minutes of the earthquake, and that people didn't have time to run for higher ground. Is that what you saw?
Yes, pretty much. The earthquake actually hit around about 5 to 7 this morning, and within 10 minutes, less than 10 minutes, the waves started coming. There was actually one or two waves that came through. It wasn't just one singular wave. A friend of mine that used to have a resort down the coast reported that it was actually four waves that came through and just destroyed his resort.
So when you were going down to help people that were on the beach there, what were you doing? How were you helping the survivors?
Just basically searching the rooms of the hotel, making sure there was nobody trapped under debris, and trying to assist getting people out. There's mainly cuts and bruises and a few more serious, like broken bones and stuff. But, we managed to get most people out. There was a significant warning, but just to get people out, there was sirens that went off, but it was just so fast.
So have you seen the Red Cross there, so international aid workers?
The local authorities here have been working around the clock. The power is partially back on now on the south coast. But the hospital staff and people, just everyone's been coming together and everyone's helping everybody.
Thank you very much. Ian Cooper, whose diving business, Liquid Motion Limited, was completely destroyed in the tsunami that hit the Samoan islands. John, I imagine that some of the people listening may have relatives or family members in Samoa, American Samoa, or maybe in Indonesia. If you do, give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Let us know what you've heard or are concerned about with what's going on in the Samoa.
Well, typically the community of the Internet is all alive with this. You can go online and see pictures from all over the area of Samoa and Western Samoa, and also pictures are now coming in, and you can find them certainly online of the aftermath in Indonesia.
They must still
as well
have cell phone coverage, because I'm seeing cell phone pictures being on the Internet. President Barack Obama has declared it a major disaster area, and he authorized federal aid to supplement local recovery efforts there.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. What's your favorite genre of music, Celeste?
I think I'm contractually obligated to say opera.
Opera. Well, and there is a lot of nationalistic music that's opera. Wagner is kind of nationalistic.
Yes.
Some would say Beethoven is nationalistic music.
You could make that argument.
You could make that argument. Well, Celeste, listen to this. For propaganda art, you can't beat the People's Republic of China. That's a song called "The East Is." It's a scene from "East Is Red," a song and dance epic, kind of an opera promoting communism and Chairman Mao back in the early 60s. And we've come a long way. Listen to this more modern, but I think equally dramatic sounding "Founding of a Republic," written in 2009. 中国人打中国人, That's the trailer of Founding of a Republic 2009. It's a movie, part of the celebration of the 60th anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic of China. Joining us now is Quentin Somerville, BBC Beijing correspondent. 60th anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic. It's going to beat the Olympics for a sheer spectacle, right, Quentin?
It is going to beat the Olympics. They're going to use twice as much fireworks tomorrow, Thursday, when the celebration takes place, a massive military parade. But if you're a resident in Beijing, the advice from the authorities, please do enjoy the parade on television at home. This city is in lockdown. There is security everywhere. I've never seen anything like it. Snipers on the roof along the parade route. And most Beijing residents, most businesses, most shops have all closed to celebrate the 60th anniversary.
Now, you don't usually associate state produced propaganda movies with being star-studded celebrity vehicles, but apparently there are like 200 huge Chinese celebrities, including Jackie Chan and Jet Li, in this movie, which will be released tomorrow, right?
founding of a republic. It's actually in cinemas across China right now, in practically every cinema in the country.
Wow.
Some cinemas, in fact, it's the only movie showing, and it has 172 stars. Everyone from Zhang Ziyi, from Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, to Jackie Chan, who plays a mustachioed, bespectacled, rather humble journalist. They all have these tiny little cameos because there's so many of them being squeezed into this 2.5-hour film. It's supposed to be a kind of Hollywood treatment of Mao Zedong's rise, his defeat of Chiang Kai-shek, who led the nationalists in the Civil War. What is interesting about this, it's propaganda, there's no two ways about it, but actually the nationalists get a fair crack of the whip here, and it's a fairly sympathetic portrayal of Chiang Kai-shek. I would guess that people in Taiwan wouldn't have too much trouble with it.
Any mention of the Cultural Revolution in the 70s?
What do you think? No, there's no mention of the Cultural Revolution. And Mao Zedong is this rather jolly, avuncular figure. He smiles a lot. He doesn't lose his temper. He smokes an incredible amount. We even get to see him in his dressing gown.
That is true.
Yes, he does. He smokes all the time.
Quentin Somerville, happy 60th. The BBC Beijing correspondent joined us. He was talking about the official celebration of the 60th anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic of China. The official celebration starts tomorrow. I like that idea of Mao Zedong as kind of a Santa Claus figure.
Jovial, sort of Buddha-esque, smiling guy.
He did smoke, but he was a chain smoker.
He smoked a lot.
Deng Xiaoping, I think, also a big smoker.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I think China is the biggest smoking country in the world.
Smoking leaders of the world.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, soliciting opinions about schools that offer students cash rewards for improved grades and attendance records. Is it ethical? Is it bribery? Viewpoints now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
John Huckenberry here with Celeste Headley. Coming up, fall brings the produce, new kinds of produce. Anyway, our friend and Times food writer Melissa Clark shares some strategies for dealing with all that fabulous produce in just a moment. But there's also a big summit in the nation's capital today about distracted driving. It's a serious problem, and we want to know how much multitasking you do while driving. What are your thoughts?
My name's Mimi from Detroit, and since my daughter is learning to drive, she has really been scolding me about texting. So what I'm hoping I'll start doing is locking my phone in my trunk while I'm driving, because I am completely addicted to texting, and I am definitely over 19.
Give us your distracted driving confession. Tell us your sins at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. But first, here are some of the news stories we're following at 48 minutes after the hour. A big picture economic indicator is out. The latest GDP is in. The economy dipped only 0.7% in the spring. That's a better performance than expected. This morning's numbers are seen as possible evidence that the recession is drawing to a close. Overseas witnesses say homes and bridges have collapsed in western Indonesia. A powerful earthquake hit there earlier today.
That's as President Obama has declared a major disaster in American Samoa. A South Pacific earthquake triggered a deadly tsunami there. At least 99 are dead in Samoa and American Samoa. A few minutes ago on The Takeaway, we talked to an eyewitness there. You can hear that full conversation at thetakeaway.org. The president will sit down in the Situation Room today to talk about troop levels in Afghanistan. He's meeting with his national security team. That's as there's news of an American service member dying after a suicide bomb attack there today. Those are some of the news stories we're watching this morning.
And all of that Celeste just mentioned will be on the table as the president meets with his entire national security team to talk Afghanistan strategy. Elizabeth Boumiller, a New York Times Pentagon correspondent, joins us from Washington. We've been hearing about a strategic overhaul in Afghanistan for weeks now. Is this the convening of the kind of final meeting, or what do we make of this meeting that's going on today?
Well, we're sort of towards the beginning of meetings. There's about there's one today. There was one on September 13th. There's about four or five more scheduled. But before the president says he's going to make up his mind and announce, the strategy for Afghanistan. There was a strategy in March which he announced, but now they're rethinking it and wondering if they do want to send, up to 40,000 troops. That General McChrystal, who's the top commander in Afghanistan, has apparently asked for. That's the numbers we're hearing, up to 40,000. It could be less. But there's now a look at some other strategies for sort of almost downscaling and going to just an operation where you use drone attacks from those unmanned predator drones and special forces, you know, operations, and not a massive troop presence that we have now, 68,000 troops.
You know, Elizabeth, your colleague Marcus Mabry on this program suggested that what may be going on behind the scenes here is a kind of orchestration to, in the end, endorse a troop-level increase. And I don't want to get you to speculate or anything, but
right.
Is it likely that the president's strategy is basically a way of saying, okay, now we've got the strategy right, now it's okay to bring in more troops? Any sign that one way or another the troop level number is going to be endorsed or backed away from by the administration?
Endorsed? Well, there is a view out there that the president is engaging in this exercise to let the liberal base of his party know that he didn't just rubber stamp, you know, a plan by his general in Afghanistan, and that he's thinking it through very hard. That said, I do think there are people in the White House who are, you know, genuinely pushing this other idea. So we know that Vice President Biden is one of them who wants to downscale the operation to some degree in Afghanistan. So if you want me to speculate, I suspect it's a little bit of both. I mean, I don't see how Obama could just accept a recommendation from his top general, say thank you very much, and turn around and do it. I mean, he needs to look at it closely. The other thing that we haven't mentioned here is that what has changed since he introduced the strategy in March, when he sent 21,000 new troops to Afghanistan, was that there was an election.
Right.
And Hamid Karzai was reelected, but there's been such widespread reports of fraud in the election that the United States is, you know, deeply concerned now that, yep, about what kind of a partner it has to work with in Afghanistan.
Well, a lot on the table there, and we'll see. Interesting calculation, no rubber stamp. That may actually be the headline out of this meeting on Afghanistan in Washington. Elizabeth Mueller, a New York Times Pentagon correspondent, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. All you can eat. Well, I'm going to stuff my face to a funky beat. We're going to walk inside. And guess what's up? Put the food on my plate. Add some coke in my cup. Well, it's Wednesday. That means we are talking about food here on The Takeaway. So, John, it's the end of September. When do you start baking? When is it autumn enough for you to open up the oven and turn it on?
Well, it's not a weather issue for me. It's the size of the pile of produce in my kitchen, and it's pretty big right now.
That's actually probably a problem for a lot of people. Melissa Clark, food writer for our partner, The New York Times, is here to talk about late summer and autumn foods. Melissa, so it is baking season.
Well, it is, and finally. I mean, we've been waiting for it to cool down. I don't like to turn my oven on when it gets really hot out, except for maybe the occasional pie, you know, because you have peaches and you have raspberries,
sure,
so you have to
sure,
do something.
Sure.
But now this is the time when I just want to bake all the time. I want to be cozy in my kitchen. And the good thing about this time of year is that we still have a lot of summer produce that hasn't gone away yet. We have about two more weeks of eggplants, tomatoes, mm-hmm, zucchini, and all of these are actually, you know, they're vegetables, but they're actually, botanically, they're fruit. So they're very juicy, and they're perfect for baking.
And you can't make ratatouille out of all of them.
You can.
You can, but you can
and then you can bake it like I do in my...
Baking is an option.
Right, exactly. So, I mean, you've got these amazing, juicy vegetables. You're tired of salads. You've stopped grilling at this point. Maybe you're gonna
to
retire the grill.
That's true.
And this is when it's perfect to start baking with them. And what I wrote about today in the Times is I went on this little baking spree last week when the weather started to get cool and I had all these amazing vegetables in my fridge. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to make ratatouille, but instead of just serving it regularly as kind of this warm vegetable mush or cold vegetable mush, I decided I was going to bake it into a pot pie. And that began this whole baking spree.
And you did it with like a biscuit crust.
Exactly. Because biscuits are so much easier than making a whole pie dough. And when you bake it, the thing about baking a ratatouille instead of doing it, just serving it from the stove, mm-hmm, is that because these are such juicy vegetables, the juices condense and sweeten in the oven the way that they don't really do on the stove. They really have a caramelized flavor. And that's the thing about autumn baking, is that when you're using particularly juicy summer produce, mm, and you put it in the oven, it turns into like candy. It just takes on a wonderful flavor.
I'm tasting the candy.
Yeah, there's
and that's
what you brought for us.
And that's another one of my favorite summer fruits. They're figs. I mean, they're late summer, early fall. They're in season right now. I know I have a fig tree in my backyard. You can get them at produce stands. You can get them at the supermarket. Figs are in season. Buy them and bake them, because a raw fig is a delicious thing, but baked in the oven, I mean, you guys are tasting it, right?
It's fantastic.
Okay, so, Melissa, what about all the people who still have tomatoes left?
Ah, Yeah, tomatoes are my
favorite.
Tomatoes are my favorite. I know, because finally they got good. We had a really bad tomato season, and then at the end we had gorgeous weather, and we got amazing tomatoes. And this is the time of year when sometimes you'll have a bunch of soft ones left on your counter because, you know, you haven't used them. I should have made a salad, but I didn't make a salad. What I did was I pureed those tomatoes, and I used the puree for baking. And you could use that puree as if it were applesauce in a cake. But what I did was I went out on a limb and I made tomato eclairs.
Eclairs.
So savory eclairs. this is sort of at the end of my baking spree. I'm like, what can I try next?
She was getting loopy.
I was getting a little loopy with the baking.
Was the tomato like the frosting in an eclair, or was it the inside?
It was actually the liquid in the eclair.
Inside.
Think of it this way. Do you know cheese puffs, little cheese gougère?
Yep, yep.
That dough is called a pâte à choux. And that same shoe pastry, and that same pastry is what you make an eclair out of. So I was already thinking of these cheese puffs. I was thinking savory cheese, tomatoes and cheese are such a good combination. And when you make that dough, you have about a cup of liquid. And I thought, well, why use water? Why not use tomato puree? Huh. And it infuses the pastry with this intense sweet tomato flavor. Then I filled it with a little bit of ricotta cheese that I had seasoned with garlic and basil.
It occurs to me that this is a great lunch. I mean, you can bring this as lunch into work.
Oh, yeah. Especially
it preserves well and heats up in the microwave. And
the fig tart, but the ratatouille pot pie, and the recipes for all of these are on your website, right
now? Thetakeaway.org, yes,
indeed. Go to thetakeaway.org. You can get the recipes. They're really easy. And the ratatouille pot pie is perfect for lunch.
They're really easy, even the eclair.
They're all even – well, okay, the eclair is the hardest, but it's still really easy. Still really easy.
Before we go, any more mountains to climb, a scary summer ingredient that you haven't baked with that you're dying to?
A summer ingredient that I'm dying to. Corn. I haven't done anything with corn yet. It's not a scary mountain, but I need to use it before it goes.
Okra?
I've never baked with okra. All right. You're right.
We should book her when she bakes something with okra.
Melissa Clark, friend of The Takeaway and food writer for our partner, The New York Times, bringing in delicious fig tarts. The recipes are indeed on our website at thetakeaway.org.
So we are talking about that summit in Washington on distracted driving. Did you catch it? If you didn't, it's maybe because you're distracted. Tell us your confession on how distracted are you when you drive. Do you text while you're at a red light, or how about a green light? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
Oh, I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Huckenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James O. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Bipartisan isn't a word that's being heard much on Capitol Hill right now.
We'd love to have worked with you on this plan, but there wasn't any opportunity to do that. In fact, the Speaker told, Speaker Pelosi told members of your conference that if you talk with Republicans about this, you will be shut out of the room.
The gentleman knows that's not true. The gentleman absolutely knows that's not true.
Right? I'm building bridges.
Reclaiming my time.
First put the draft up.
Reclaiming my
time.
Bridging the gap between the Republicans and Democrats with health care somewhere in the middle. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Huckenberry and Celeste Headlee from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, September 30th. I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Huckenberry.
Good morning, Celeste. This hour, what is the mission in Afghanistan? We're going to put that question to a Republican member of the Senate Armed Services Committee. Leading and lagging, the awkward dance of contradictory economic indicators. We're going to talk about that with Louise Story. And who ended one Cold War and started another? We'll find out.
But first, Congressman Jim McDermott joins us. He's a Democrat serving Washington State's 7th District. He's also a trained psychiatrist. So, Congressman, is there enough common ground between the two parties to end up getting a health care bill passed without a bunch of legislative shenanigans?
I think there absolutely is.
I was here in 93, 94 when we tried, and the difference between that time and this time is that this time the whole American public is focused on this issue in a way we've seen in the town meetings that we never saw before. People are really worried both about access and cost, and I think that will put pressure on the Congress, since we are a representative government, to do what's necessary.
Congressman McDermott, thanks. We'll get more from you in just a moment. But first, everything else you need to know this morning.
Well, in the headlines, Celeste, witnesses in western Indonesia say homes and bridges have collapsed in the wake of a 7.9 magnitude earthquake there. There are multiple reports of injuries and power outages. Meanwhile, President Obama is sending federal aid to American Samoa, where an earlier earthquake caused a South Pacific tsunami. Earlier, the Takeaway spoke to Ian Cooper, who was in Samoa when the tsunami hit and is surveying the wreckage.
Big hotels that have actually just, all that's left is a concrete slab.
At this point, at least 99 are believed dead in Samoa and American Samoa.
Back in the U.S., we've got new numbers just out this morning on the economy. It shrank last spring, but not as much as expected. The latest report shows a 0.7% drop. If trends continue, the recession could technically be over soon. Michelle Obama is in Copenhagen today. She's trying to sell Chicago as the site for the 2016 Summer Olympics. Her husband will join her later this week to give his presidential pitch. That vote is on Friday. Wall Street dipped slightly yesterday. The Dow is going to open up this hour at 97.42. The S&P starts trading at 10.61, and the NASDAQ will start out at 21.24. So they're talking about distracted driving in Washington today, and I bet there's a lot of people driving to work right now who may just be distracted by cell phone calls or incoming text messages.
Stop texting. Stop it. You really need to stop it. It could kill you.
That's right. We're asking you to give us your stories at 8778-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org, but not while you're driving.
Right.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. So the Senate Finance Committee yesterday rejected two proposals, two amendments that would have added the public option to Max Baucus's bill. But the Senate Finance Committee is still in the markup period. They're still dealing with over 500 amendments.
It looks like a show trial. It looks very showy. I can't tell if they're getting something done or if they're just putting on a show in this.
I think there's
markup.
A lot of people who are wondering that. Yeah. We have three experts to help us deal with that. This morning we're joined by Congresswoman Eddie Bernice Johnson. She serves the 30th Congressional District of Texas. That's most of Dallas. In addition to that, she also served as a nurse for 15 years. We also have Congressman Vic Snyder. He's from Arkansas's 2nd District, and he worked as a family practice physician for over 15 years. And Congressman Jim McDermott, who we heard from earlier, he serves Washington State's 7th District, and he's a trained psychiatrist. Good morning to all of you. I wanted to start with Congresswoman Johnson. You have said that you couldn't imagine supporting a bill that did not have the public option in it. Why is that?
Because there are so many people that the insurance companies will not cover. If they were intending to cover them, they'd be covered now. And the only way that it seems that they can get insurance is to have an option to pay premiums for their insurance that's affordable to them.
Now, Vic Snyder, you served in the services. You served in Vietnam, and you bring not only your military experience but also your family practice experience as well, and you say you can get health care reform done without the public option. Why do you say that?
Yeah, the public option has never been a deal breaker for me. Several reasons. First of all, even by the CBO analysis, they say at the end of 10 years or so there would only be 10 million people in the public option. I mean, it's like the tail on the dog. The tail will not wag that dog. The reality is that even if we include a public option, it will still be the private insurance companies that will be driving most of health care for working American families. And so I think in some ways what all this focus and the arguing about the public option has done has taken our eye off the ball of the insurance companies and what would be the kind of more intense regulation that would help them ultimately and help the American people. But I think that healthcare reform I think we let ourselves off the hook if we think all we have to do is include a public option and somehow that solves all our problems. I don't think that's the case, and And also politically, I don't think it's going to be in the final bill that's signed into law.
So, Congressman McDermott, you actually started a healthcare system in Washington. Can you tell me about that?
Well, a number of years ago, this was in the 80s, I started a what's called a basic health plan for the working poor. It was basically to meet the needs of those people who did not have enough money to buy into the system, you know, generally, but who were not eligible for Medicaid. They were not poor enough for that. So I put together a subsidized program, and it's possible for us to do that nationally.
That was the first state program in the country to provide low-cost health insurance. Was that a so-called public option?
Sure was. People of all walks of life who couldn't get insurance any other way could get into the Washington Basic Health Plan. It didn't have any preconditions. You couldn't be excluded for any illness or injury. And it worked very well. I mean, when tight budget times like now, they've been cutting it, but it's worked very well.
So, again, these are all, we're speaking with all Democrats today. We're going to speak to the Republicans tomorrow. And a question for you, Congresswoman Johnson. The Senate just turned down the two public option amendments, and yet the House has, Speaker Pelosi says the public option is probably a deal breaker. Are you guys going to be able to reconcile a bill together?
You know, all I'm interested in is making sure that every person has an option to purchase a premium to cover themselves. It can be a public option. Perhaps it can be something else. Whomever can think of some way that it can be done, I'm willing to listen. But I do think that that is not the only thing that I'm concerned about. I'm still concerned about the other components, with no previous condition, with competition so that some of the prices can go down, not dropping people when they become ill. I just think that there is more to it than the public option, but
right.
I want to know what process would be used to make sure that people who are not covered now can get coverage.
Well,
that they can afford.
Congresswoman Johnson and Congressman Vic Snyder of Arkansas and Congressman Jim McDermott of Washington State, I mean, you're all Democrats, true, but we asked you to come on the program because you all have medical expertise. Congressman Anybody's Johnson, you're a nurse. We should remind people, Vic Snyder, you were a family physician. And Jim McDermott, you're a trained psychiatrist. You know, I'm scratching my head here a little bit. To have that medical background, does that make you, does that give you more authority in this health care reform debate, or do people accuse you guys of being special interests? Congresswoman Johnson, you first, and I just want a response from everybody.
Well, I don't know that I would be considered special interest. I don't serve on any committee that covers these subjects. I do keep up with it, but I also know that I've been on the side where people cannot get health insurance. I've been on the side where the insurance companies will not pay for the first day in a hospital, and that's one of the most expensive days, and they won't pay for the last day in the hospital, and that is the one where they do the evaluation to make sure you're ready to go home. So those are the most expensive days usually in a hospital. I do think that much of this reform has to be with insurance companies.
Congressman Snyder, are people looking to you for insight into the healthcare debate?
Well, healthcare is one of those issues that everybody has insight. I don't care what your business is. I tell my friends and have for the 20 years I've been in public life, which is in medical school, they teach about nosebleeds and sprained ankles. They don't teach you about insurance law. And a lot of what we're talking about is the complications of these man-made institutions. But I'll give you my favorite example. Recently, I was on a plane a couple of weeks ago flying into Little Rock, and it's nighttime, and a guy gets up in the seat to head to the bathroom, and the plane's dark except for just the reading lights, and he sticks this note in my hand. Here, I want you to read this. Well, what it was, he was a small business person desperate for something to happen on health care because his premiums are going up every year, and it's killing him and killing the small business he works with. But he had written his note on a barf bag. You know, but he was so desperate to get the message out. Don't listen to these people who are trying to scare you off of doing anything. It has to be done. So I think those are the voices that we hear. My friends that are doctors, they're divided. Nurses are divided. I mean, Americans are divided on this. But ultimately, it comes down to there's a substantial segment of the American public that knows that what's going on isn't working for everyone as well as it should. Now, they've got apprehensions about where we're going with it, but they're very willing to keep listening to, can we come up with a workable solution that we can pay for? And I think that's where Jim and Eddie Bernice and I are all in agreement. We want to see something move this ball down the field, because what we're doing now isn't working for America like it ought to.
Okay, so Congressman Jim McDermott, let me start with you. Eventually, at some point, the House bill and the Senate bill have to get reconciled in order to come up with some kind of law to get passed and send to the president. So give me the three things that you absolutely have to see in the health care bill in order for you to vote for it.
Well, there has to be some way to make sure that everybody has access. And I think that a public option is the most logical way to do that. I think that there'll be lots of argument about what is a public option. When we talk about it here on the phone and everybody's listening all over the place, everybody has a different idea in mind. But there should be a way that no matter what your circumstances in this country are, you should be able to get health insurance that can never be taken away, so you can't be broken by a illness or an injury. With bankruptcies as the major cause, or health care bills as the major cause of bankruptcy.
Yeah, 60% or so.
Yes, you have got to find a way to give American security, and part of that is controlling costs. So I think anything that happened yesterday, people shouldn't say that's the end. You don't watch a football game and watch a play in the second quarter and say, well, that's the end of the game. The game is going to go on and on and on until we get it done.
Vix, Congressman Snyder, what thing do you have to have in the bill to vote for it?
We have to see some aspect of insurance law reform. What Eddie Bernice was talking about, I agree 100%, deal with this issue of lifetime caps and pre-existing conditions. We have to recognize that people need to be required to be in the system, but if we're going to do that, then there has to be subsidies to help them be able to pay for it. I think that's the core crux of a plan. And then one other part of that would have to be there's got to be some kind of standardization of a package of benefits. We want people to have real policies, not policies that have huge deductibles and a lot of gaps in coverage.
Okay, that's Congressman Vic Snyder from Arkansas, also Congressman Jim McDermott from Washington State, and Congresswoman Eddie Bernice Johnson from the 30th Congressional District of Texas. Tomorrow we're going to hear from Republican legislators who are medical professionals about health care legislation. If you're a health care professional, we want to hear what you're going to be watching as this health care bill proceeds through the Congress. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Sometimes those Seahawks games are over in the second quarter. I feel for Jim McDermott there.
Oh, that was painful.
Call us now with your thoughts on the news at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253.
Now, some quick takeouts on stories we're following this week. We'll start with Todd Zwillick, the Takeaway's Washington correspondent. Todd, the House Majority Leader is sitting down with automakers and auto dealers today. What are they going to be talking about?
Yeah, this is a rare meeting. You know, the leadership in the House and Senate don't usually get involved in business disputes, and this is what this is. You remember the auto bailouts and the managed bankruptcies of GM and Chrysler, of course.
How could I forget?
Yeah, and one group that really got left out in the cold, among others, was the dealers. Thousands of them got closed in these bankruptcies, and the dealers want some protection and some compensation. We got a hold of House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer yesterday. Here's what he had to say about it.
Many of us feel that the dealers were treated relatively without any kind of due process or other process to determine whether or not they were the ones that should, in fact, be closed.
Now, Steny Hoyer's doing a little bit of politics here. Of course, almost every district in the nation has a dealer, and many of them are upset. They're politically powerful. The House has passed bills trying to get more compensation for dealers, but the Senate's not interested. The Obama administration isn't interested. So it seems like Steny Hoyer's trying to do his best publicly by the dealers by inviting them in. Whether he'll get anything for them out of it is another story, I guess.
Also on Capitol Hill, there's a movement to expand some presidential powers in a way. What's up with that?
Oh, yeah, well, this is about Iran. Of course, tomorrow the talks in Geneva start, re-kicking those talks with Iran on its nuclear enrichment program. The United States is involved, and the relevant parties in the Senate and the House are starting to move forward with increased sanctions now to give some more teeth to the Obama administration. Chris Dodd is going to be introducing a bill today or tomorrow. He's in the Banking Committee, which interestingly has jurisdiction over this. A lot of this is about gasoline. Iran has a lot of oil production, but not a lot of refining capacity, so this makes it harder for Iran on to import gasoline, makes it harder for companies that do business with the United States to send gasoline to Iran. In fact, bans it. So they're really trying to clamp down on the on Iran here as the administration heads into the talks.
Okay, so Todd, I really don't want to delve into your personal life, but you went to a sold-out U2 show in Washington last night, and something kind of interesting happened. What was that?
Oh, yeah, it was interesting. This is a packed show, you know, 92,000 people at FedEx Field in Washington for U2, and it was a real kind of Washington moment. You know, most people know that Bono is involved in issues of debt relief and world hunger and African relief. He's turned into a wonk, I have to say. He shouted out everyone from Nancy Pelosi and Pat Leahy and Tom Daschle, who were apparently in attendance, to Josh Bolton and Bill Frist. He even made a reference at one point to OMB, which is the White House Office of Management and Budget. That's the budget office. Most people didn't know what he was talking about. You know, he got a little wonky like I do sometimes. Bono.
orchestral maneuvers in the bank.
A real Washington moment, yeah.
That's great.
Todd Zwillick, Takeaway's Washington correspondent. Now it's time to talk sports with Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. So, Ibrahim, even after two games yesterday, the race in the American League Central is still very, very tight. What happened?
Well, yesterday they played a doubleheader, the Minnesota Twins versus the Detroit Tigers. The first game, Minnesota got a game on them. They played
10-inning nail-biter. Wow.
Yeah. Minnesota won 3-2. It was a really tough game. And then in the second game...
Still close.
Definitely still close. They had drawn the lead in the division, AL Central, down to one game. And then in the second game, they brought to the mound their ace, Justin Verlander. And then the Tigers ended up winning 6-5. The interesting thing about this is that everyone has their routine in the morning. You drink your coffee, whatever you do in the morning is your routine. Justin Verlander kept his routine. So for the listeners out there thinking about, he didn't watch the beginning of the first game. He was in bed at the beginning of the first game, and he kept his routine.
He didn't change anything.
Exactly. And that's what I think... With a big game pitcher like this, you keep your rhythm, and that's how you stay successful. And then he came in and he did what he was supposed to do.
There's another important race coming up here. It's the 2009 chase for the NASCAR Sprint Cup. There was a race 2 weeks ago. Race two was this past Sunday, and then we have race three that's coming up at the Kansas Speedway. What's going on with this race?
So our listeners know, the NASCAR is the National Association for Stock Car Auto Racing.
Right.
And it sanctions over 1,500 races at over 100 tracks in 39 states. And this is an interesting stat. Professional football is the only sport in the United States that holds more viewers than NASCAR. NASCAR is a huge sport in the country. So right now there are 13 drivers in the chase, and the leader is a guy, a 50 years old.
Why are you pointing at me? What was that about?
He's in the lead, and he's being chased by Jimmy Johnson, and who's attempting to be the only 4-year consecutive winner. So really, Jimmy Johnson is the guy that everyone's watching. They have 8 races left in the series, and people think that he's going to eclipse him. But right now, it's still a close one, and Mark Martin is still in the lead.
All right, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, the Takeaway sports contributor. Thanks for that quick takeout.
So let me get this straight: you're a NASCAR mom.
No, not really.
Close. So our last takeout comes from our listeners, from you guys. There's a big summit in the nation's capital today about what you might do on the road, okay? Do you text? Are you electronically distracted? Distracted driving is at the top of the agenda for a summit gathering in Washington today. But let's check in on how much multitasking you do while driving. The answer is apparently quite a lot.
My name is Nick from West Bloomfield, Michigan. At one point, I was going with the flow of traffic and trying to find the perfect song on my iPod. Next thing I knew, traffic stopped in front of me, and I had to hit the brakes. I skidded a little bit and went up on the median and realized that the song was not that important. I didn't get into an accident, but I did take an opposite way home. I was kind of embarrassed, and I had to pull over and settle my nerves.
I can't resist replying to emails while I'm driving. And the buttons on this thing are tiny. I try to do it when I'm sitting at a stoplight. Would they give me a ticket for that?
Ron from Detroit, Michigan. I am very, very guilty for having a egg McMuffin in the morning while driving, trying to bite to that wonderful McMuffin, looking up at the light at the same time. Bad, bad, bad.
These are great stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE. So who's more to blame for all this distractedness?
I'm 23 years old, and I think that my generation is probably the most guilty for our distracted driving, and I am among them. the other day, I was exiting off of the highway on the way to my friend's house. I looked down at my phone, and I was in an unfamiliar area, and I was so close to crashing into the car in front of me. Really, the only thing that saved me was the brakes on my brand new car, which are nearly dead now. It's absolutely a terrible, terrible habit, and I don't even know how to detach myself from my phone.
So come on, people. People, let's have some practical information.
One of the scariest things that I saw is a PSA that was done in England regarding texting. It's actually probably about 3 to 4 minutes long, and it shows the whole thing, the crash happening, the aftermath of the crash, and I think that it's something that we should be putting on the air here. Thank you.
Great stuff. HWP emails us, how about an auto-reply cell phone setting? Get back to you. I'm driving now. Great stuff. Keep the stories coming. Confess your distracted driving tales at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. There's your takeout this morning.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at GatesFoundation.org and by the Freeman Foundation.
Good morning, everyone. Coming up, we talk about the strategies in Afghanistan with Georgia Senator Saxby Chambliss in just a moment. But here are some of the news stories we're following at 32 minutes after the hour. Wall Street is open and trading upward on news that the GDP in the second quarter was better than expected. President Obama declares America Samoa a disaster area. Major earthquake caused a tsunami that swamped American Samoa and nearby islands today or yesterday. More than 100 are dead. Separate earthquake today rocked western Indonesia. Reports of injuries, collapsed homes, and power outages. The region is no longer on a tsunami alert, however.
Back in the U.S., President Obama is expected to announce $5 billion in stimulus funding for disease research. He'll make that announcement later today at the National Institutes of Health. In other health news, senators are back working on the health care overhaul today. That's after voting to reject two Democratic proposals to add a so-called public option to Senator Max Baucus's bill. And Chicago making its final push for the 2016 Olympics. They've got First Lady Michelle Obama helping them out in Copenhagen. The president will be there later this week. Those are some of the stories we're following.
So the president meets today with his entire national security team in Washington. The meeting is to discuss strategy in Afghanistan, a strategy which is being overhauled, as we understand. We've learned that for weeks. There are calls from the top U.S. General Stanley McChrystal in Afghanistan for more troops. And today's meeting is a string of strategy sessions, a part of a whole a program for re-strategizing Afghanistan. Yesterday, the Secretary General of NATO met with the president, and the president said there was a lot of agreement there.
We both agree that it is absolutely critical that we are successful in dismantling, disrupting, destroying the Al-Qaeda network, and that we are effectively working with the Afghan government to provide the security necessary for that country.
Barack Obama at a photo op yesterday with NATO Secretary General Anders Rasmussen. Does the agreement, though, that the president talked about there extend across the aisle on Capitol Hill? Joining us now is Senator Saxby Chambliss, member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, Republican of Georgia. Good morning, Senator.
Good morning, John. How are you today?
I'm doing great. And let me just get the elevator pitch from you. What is, in your most succinct terms, the mission, as you understand it, in Afghanistan?
Well, the mission's pretty clear, that we need to disrupt the ability of terrorists to have a safe haven for the training, equipping, and directing of groups of terrorists around the world who want to kill and harm Americans as well as other individuals. And right now, obviously, we know that there are terrorist training camps that are ongoing in both Pakistan and Afghanistan. And let's make no mistake about it, John. I mean, Pakistan and Afghanistan are somewhat linked together. But the fact is, we need to make sure that there is no ability on the part of the terrorists to have that safe haven for training individuals to send around the world to carry out acts of terrorism.
Well, certainly Al-Qaeda was very successful on 9/11 in the United States, in what happened at the World Trade Center and at the Pentagon. But would you have expected when this war began in October of 2001 that we would still be fighting 8 years later a ragtag band of terrorists who had one hit, hasn't done much since, and is holed up in some caves in Pakistan?
Well, the direct answer is no. I don't think any of us did. But what you have to remember is that, first of all, we went into Afghanistan in October 8 years ago, and we did a pretty good job of cleaning it up. Unfortunately, we didn't finish the job back then, and we got refocused on Iraq. And now we're having to go back, and instead of having more of those bad guys already cleaned out there, we're finding that the numbers have grown significantly. And these guys have been fighting, John, for the last 20 to 25 years. It's a little bit different scenario than what we had in Iraq.
Although maybe there are some similarities with what happened 20 years ago or more in Afghanistan with the Russians. We've got this arrest of Najibullah Zazi, of course, that the Justice Department is looking into, that he is a terrorist who wanted to target the United States. Is it possible that we're turning into an occupation in Afghanistan and that creating a climate for insurgents to attack the United States because we're in Afghanistan?
I'm not sure that you can say at this point in time that it's an occupation, but let's be realistic, too, John. We're going to be there for a long time to come, after the military situation has provided security to the Afghan people. And the reason is that Afghanis have a literacy rate of less than 20%. That means at least 8 out of 10 Afghans don't have the ability to read and write. So how are they going to make a living? How are they going to generate an economy with a literacy rate like that?
Okay, Senator, then is that what the 40,000 troops General McChrystal has called for is going to do, teach them to read? I mean, what are those troops going to be doing?
No, what we've got to do with the 40,000 troops, John, is to provide security and to stop the violence. That's what happened in Iraq, and that's what can happen here. Once that happens, then you can sort of see the government stabilize, which is a whole other issue, but with the Afghan government. But once you have security and you stop the violence, or at least lower the level, then you have the ability to see the government stabilize, see the people get confidence in not just the American troops, but in their own troops, their own government. And in Iraq, you saw an awful lot of support generated by the Sons of Iraq and a group of sheikhs who came together. And once that happened, then the security process moved
right
along at a very rapid rate.
But we went through a very bloody period to get there. There's a service member killed this morning by a suicide bomber. You don't call it an occupation. Maybe I wouldn't call it an occupation yet, but it's maybe not important what we think. If people in Afghanistan think it's an occupation, that becomes an excuse to attack the United States. Are you worried about that?
It's not the people of Afghanistan that are attacking NATO and U.S. posts or soldiers. It is truly the Taliban that's doing that. The Afghan people really have no use for the Taliban per se. The problem with the Afghans is that, as we mentioned earlier, we went in 8 years ago, we pulled out, we left them hanging dry, and they've got to have confidence that we're not going to do that again, because they know that if we do, then the Taliban leadership will make sure that those that supported Americans or NATO troops are killed, or their family members are killed, or whatever. So I wouldn't characterize it an occupation right now, but frankly, we are going to be there for the long term.
Senator, quickly, do you think that there's a chance that failing public opinion in the United States is going to jeopardize the mission in Afghanistan?
Well, Celeste, this is one of those difficult decisions that a president has to make from time to time. George Bush had a number of scenarios where he was put in this position. That being where public opinion is so strongly against you, and certainly you have to take that into consideration. But at the end of the day, you got to do the right thing for your country.
And we're apparently far from the end of that day, it sounds like, in Afghanistan. Thanks so much for being with us, Senator Saxby Chambliss, member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, along with the Obama administration, considering the strategy in Afghanistan. Coming up, is the Cold War actually over? And if it is, who ended it? Neil Sheehan, the author, will be with us, and we'll ask him.
WWE.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. The clothing maker American Apparel, that specializes in T-shirts, is firing 1,800 of its workers this month. That's more than a quarter of their workforce, but they're not interested in saving money. The firings are prompted by something entirely different. Joining us is Julia Preston, national immigration correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. Julia, why are these workers being fired from American Apparel?
An investigation that started more than a year ago determined that there were mismatches, irregularities between the documents they presented when they were hired and the records of immigration or the Social Security Administration. That is to say, in all likelihood, they are illegal immigrants.
But this is not what we think of as a stereotypical relationship between illegal immigrants and the company. The company's actually paying some of these workers $900 a week. And here's what one worker at American Apparel had to say.
Being realistic, I guess I'm going to have to go to one of those sweatshop companies where I'm going to get paid under the table, not paying taxes as I do, because or just be invisible to the government.
So these are workers who are being paid very well, and they were paying taxes.
Yes, that's right. This is the dilemma that's presented by a new policy by the Obama administration. The focus is on employers, but as officials from the administration say, it's not just sweatshop employers, but they are going to try and be looking at the records of employers across the country, mainstream employers, any company that has a large number of immigrant workers, to see if their hiring documents are in order.
This is actually, you spoke with a congressman about this new policy, and this is what he had to say.
There's not going to be any place for you to hide illegally in America anymore, because the light is going to be shined in every corner.
That's Congressman Brian Bill Bray from California. How this seems like a good policy. We want to preserve jobs for American workers, but is it turning out to be good for American Apparel or their workers?
Well, it the problem is that, of course, it's a very bad job market in Los Angeles, and many of these workers have been with American Apparel for 9 years, 10 years. At the time when they hired on, there really was not a satisfactory regimen for verifying their employment. So one of the details of this action is that the company itself has not been accused so far of a single case of knowingly hiring an illegal immigrant. But there it is.
Jobs going to go to Los Angelinos now, legal residents?
Well, to judge from the lines of applicants who were standing out in front of the company, it looks like it's pretty much the same group of workers, mostly Spanish-speaking immigrants, who are going to apply for those jobs.
Who are legal, though?
Well, the company has changed its hiring practices to scrutinize the documentation more carefully. But the scenario that that this is somehow clearing the way for something that someone who we might call an American worker, this is just not exactly what's happening.
Okay, Julia Preston, national immigration correspondent for our partner, The New York Times.
She's the best. Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. Coming up, Pulitzer Prize-winning author Neil Sheehan on his new book, A Fiery Peace in a Cold War. More on that in a moment. We're also talking about distracted driving. There's a summit on distracted drivers. What, are you distracted right now?
What?
Distracted,
what are we
right
talking
now?
About?
you should come in here and see how distracted radio hosting is for both of us. You can tell us your distracted driving sins at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. But first, news stories. stories we're following at 48 minutes after the hour. Western Indonesia, 13 dead after a strong earthquake hit earlier today. Multiple reports of injuries, home collapses, and power outages. In Asia, President Obama is sending federal aid to American Samoa, where an earlier earthquake caused a tsunami in the South Pacific. Ian Cooper was in Samoa when it hit. We talked to him earlier on The Takeaway.
The whole of the south coast of Apulu in Samoa is basically washed away. It looks like someone's just come through and just wiped it clean.
At least 100 are dead in American Samoa and nearby islands. Many more are missing, and the death toll is expected to rise.
Back in the U.S., there's something of a bright spot in the economy today. The latest GDP numbers show it shrank in the spring, but not as much as expected. It dipped 0.7% in the second quarter. And Toyota is recalling floor mats from several Toyota and Lexus models. They may slip and jam the gas pedal. The recall order covers nearly 4 million vehicles. Toyota issued a smaller recall of floor mats in 2000. You can see the full list of cars affected on our site at thetakeaway.org. Those are some of the news stories that we're following this morning.
You know, you might say Neil Sheehan takes his time as a writer and a journalist. He was one of the young reporters who made his name in the early days of the Vietnam War, along with David Halberstam, Peter Arnett, Morley Safer, Ed Bradley, others. He took more than 15 years to write A Bright Shining Lie, arguably the best book on the Vietnam War. It won the National Book Award in 1988. He took about as long on his latest book. It's written about the Cold War. A fiery piece in a Cold War is the story of how a superpower race to make bigger atomic bombs became a much more deadly intercontinental ballistic missile race. The story is told through the battles of Air Force General Bernard Schriever, who in many way started that missile war, and it's a missile war that's still going on in other places around the world. Neil Sheehan, my first question, I think, would ordinarily be my last question. You called this book A Fiery Peace in a Cold War. Is the Cold War over?
It's over with the Russians. We and the Russians have a totally different relationship than we did during the Cold War. And you have smaller Cold Wars in effect with Iran and North Korea. Nothing like what existed during the real Cold War. And this period which I write about, people think of the Cold War as one glacial age, but it wasn't. In the early years, it was a very warm, unstable confrontation with both sides jockeying for position, and you could very well have gotten a nuclear war. Had it not been for the work of Schriever and those who collaborated with him, you and I might not be talking here now. We might be irradiated dust.
Indeed. I mean, in many ways, this is the story of your main character, Bernard Schriever.
Right.
Who confronted General Curtis LeMay, perhaps the greatest sort of Air Force hero of World War II, who was responsible for the B-52 bomber, which we began the Cold War thinking was our nuclear shield in the United States.
Our nuclear deterrent, our nuclear shield, was based on the bomber, right.
Right.
As in the 50s, the B-52. And LeMay had been the great bomber leader of World War II, and he believed in the bomber. He was emotionally wedded to it. He couldn't see anything else. LeMay was ignoring the fact that the Soviets were not going to try to imitate his strategic air force. They were going to build a force of intercontinental ballistic missiles. An ICBM is a rocket with a warhead that contains a hydrogen bomb. In the 50s, you had only 15 minutes warning of these coming in. If the Russians had built a fleet of these things, they would have destroyed the credibility of LeMay's airplanes, because how are you going to get them off the ground in time? You could do things like having airborne alerts, et cetera, but it still would have destroyed the credibility of the airplane, and it might have then led to adventurism by Soviet leaders, which would have triggered a nuclear war.
But Curtis LeMay at the time, when he controlled the bomber fleet, was one of the most powerful people in the Pentagon. Who was Bernard Schriever that he could confront Curtis LeMay, and what was it about him that he knew the future belonged to the intercontinental ballistic missile?
Schriever was a technological visionary. He saw that it was possible to build these ICBMs. And then he went about recruiting the people who could help him. They started in a vacant Roman Catholic schoolhouse in Inglewood outside the Los Angeles suburb, wearing civilian clothes. Mm-hmm. But he was able to get this program going despite the opposition of LeMay, who, when he was briefed on the thing, said, "When you get through fooling with those effing firecrackers, come and see me." I mean, he was that scornful of the whole thing.
Who did he have to convince, though, to leapfrog over LeMay and basically begin the modern nuclear age that happened from really the 1960s straight through to the end of the Cold War?
They had to get to President Eisenhower, and they had to get from him streamlined decision-making and funding that nobody else could touch, that belonged to them. Now, you don't just, as I say, ring up the president and say, I'd like to brief you. So what they did was they started an intrigue. They got a senator named Henry Scoop Jackson, who was a hawk from Washington State.
Yes, indeed.
To hold hearings. Shriver slipped him classified information, classified reports on what they were doing. Von Neumann, who was a brilliant Princeton mathematical physicist whom Shriver recruited for the program, and a man named Trevor Gardner, who was the Assistant Secretary of the Air Force for Research and Development, whom he'd also recruited. They got involved in the thing. They testified to a committee Jackson headed. Jackson then wrote a letter, he and another senator, to Eisenhower saying, look, you've got to look into this thing. And Eisenhower then scheduled a briefing for himself and the National Security Council, not knowing that the people who drafted this letter were Shriver and Gardner and von Neumann. And they proceeded then to convince the president. They briefed the whole National Security Council.
And they were convinced.
They came in just under the wire. Eisenhower was signed off on it, and the briefing was held on July 28th. Eisenhower signed off on it on September 13th, and then he had his heart attack 10 days later.
Oh, wow. I read a criticism of the book and of Shriver, actually, in which they said that he and his colleagues were building this technology and very excited about the technology and the weaponry itself, and they concerned themselves with the weapons and not their moral consequences. Do you think that's a fair criticism?
No, it's not, because that would be true of LeMay. LeMay was not interested in the moral consequences. He was interested in blowing up the Soviet Union. He wanted bigger bombs. Shriver and the people who worked with him were building a weapon which Shriver said over and over again was not to be used. The first weapon in the history of warfare that was being built to deter war, because they understood the consequences of nuclear war. They were trying to prevent it. It's an irony, but it's a reality that if you can deter through the weaponry, you prevent the weaponry from ever being used.
So, but there's still a genie out of the bottle here that not even Shriver could see.
Of course, once you got Trinity, the first test of an atomic bomb in the desert in New Mexico in 1945, the genie was out of the bottle, because the big secret was, could you build one of these bombs? Well, they built it, and it went off. And then the genie was out. Then the Russians got theirs in 49. So you had to bring some stability to this situation.
Finally, do you think in the Pentagon today there are generals like Bernard Shriver, who had a technical expertise, a certain kind of humanitarian vision of how the weapon would be used, and the guts to confront a four-star general and then even a president?
I'm told by some of the Air Force generals I've met that the bureaucracy is so big now you couldn't do what he did. You just couldn't do it. They'd crush you. That may be true. I don't know. But you don't know until you get a figure like him. Mm. And people like Bernard Shriver are rare. I mean, I believe in writing history in order to bring it alive so that people will be able to understand it in a human way. I did that with Van in Vietnam.
Sure, and Bright Shining Line.
I was able to do it for the Cold War with Bernard Shriver, because here was a man who I could use as a lens to tell the story in personal terms and to get a good driving narrative in novelistic form without distorting history that would bring it alive. So you just don't know until you get a guy like this who comes along and pulls off what nobody else can do.
It's certainly the case. Perhaps Bernard Shriver saved the world back in the 1960s, but we are certainly living all the consequences of his genies here in the 21st century. Bernard Shriver is the subject of Neil Sheehan's new book, A Fiery Peace in a Cold War, Bernard Shriver and the Ultimate Weapon. Thanks so much to Neil Sheehan for being here and telling that story in person.
We're also dealing with the consequences of some other technology, distracted driving. People are texting, it's causing crashes, and we're asking you, how much multitasking do you do while you're driving?
Jason from Wakefield, Rhode Island. Looking around, my distraction. I gotta look at everything.
And here's another one.
Hello, my name's Tom. I'm calling from Michigan. I want the guy who plays the trumpet on M14 to call in and tell me how he does it, because that is impressive.
You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE, especially if you're
Michigan Route 14.
If you're the guy playing trumpet on M14, give us a call, 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can also email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Also, we got an email. I live in the Netherlands. American distractors are so distracted, I saw someone almost hit a bicyclist, and they get a fine there for €150 on the
That's
spot.
That's real money.
That's right. Let us know what you have to say. say, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James O. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.